Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and on this program, we are going to be dealing with the Aztec UFO crash of 1948. In 1947 and 1948, in New Mexico, there were several incidents that shook the foundation of what men at that time believed. All of a sudden, there seemed to be evidence of life in other places, other planets far, far away. There were at least four crashes of UFOs. One of them occurred at a place called Aztec, New Mexico, in this unlikely spot of scenic wilderness. Belief that the human race was superior to everything else was shaken to the core. This is a follow-up program, the Aztec Symposium, held every year in Aztec. The 13th anniversary was something else. Lynn Buchanan, a noted and respected remote viewer, along with a cadre of others, actually focused in on the crash of 1948, and his results were astounding. First of all, let's talk to Janet Saylor, our special correspondent, who was there when Lynn made the presentation. Janet, welcome back to the program. And he had 11 remote viewers altogether. I wonder how experienced these remote viewers really are.
But of the people who worked with him, he said they had between 1 and 13 years experience, and there was only one person who had one year of experience, and everybody else actually had between like 8 and 13 years of experience. And that overall, as a group, this group of people had a dependability rating of 68 to 89%, which he felt was pretty high. He says each viewer comes to the task from their own vantage point. You know, that's why you have a group of say, 8 to 10 to 11 or 12 viewers all kind of tasking on the same project, because it's kind of like the facets of a diamond. You know, depending upon which direction you're coming at it from, it could look a little bit different. And so they get a whole lot more information that way from people, and they can piece it together and make it work a whole lot better for them. So he explained all of that first, and he said that in this particular program, they never actually asked, was there a crash? And so, but they never in any way put that into any of their questions or gave them any hint at all. And he said that there's really, he sort of apologized. He said that he didn't feel, in retrospect, he didn't feel that they had really asked the questions as well as they could have. And but he was very happy with the responses that they got, and he would, you know, he says more detailed tasking is needed on these things because they got so many really good responses, and they can now parse them out and get more and more and more detailed information, including things as detailed as like the size of the saucer that this one person saw. He said we can keep sending people in with new tasking instructions, and at some point we can end up with it, you know, to the square millimeter, how big that thing was. And I thought it was pretty, really, very, very fascinating.
Janet, we really appreciate you going into Aztec and covering this for us. In our previous program, which people can hear, it's right here on this page, we did it the night before Lynn made his presentation on Saturday. And you had just received the written report from Lynn. He was nice enough to give it to us. And it was a little confusing. But I think that's because they tasked these remote viewers not only about the crash, but where was the wreckage taken. So I think we got a little of that mixed in there.
Well, I thought they were looking at the actual crash or whatever, but they were actually seeing where the materials were taken once the crash had happened, and once they were able to get it onto trucks and whatnot. So those descriptions that I read to you last night about what people saw in terms of boxes, you know, a cube-like box and a campus-like setting and things like that. Now, he said that made perfect sense to them in the context of things, because that was the way they were tasking them. And, oh, and here's some more interesting things. You know, do you remember when we talked about people seeing the woman? Yeah, they each saw a woman, and they described her very similarly in each case, and they saw dogs, or they saw the animals. Well, according to Lynn, it is typical for remote viewers to view aliens, to view extraterrestrials as either women or dogs. That just blew me away.
Yeah, when you first got the report, you and I spent a little time speculating on where they took the wreckage, where this place might be.
And, of course, my first thought was that some of this stuff could have been Delphi, and I still think that actually one of those answers referred to the Delphi underground base. But, you know, I'm remembering pictures from Los Alamos in 1948, and to me, anyway, that looks to me like there's some resemblance to that, too. I would have to go and look at some old pictures again, but the ones that I remember seem to me that they would certainly work with the kind of descriptions that we talked about last night.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn suggested that maybe it was a university or some government installation somewhere here or somewhere else. Now, they did come into, they came to some very specific conclusions after looking at all this information. And I can give you those. There was an overview. He says, I'll just read some of this to you because it says it much better than I could even ever paraphrase.
Okay, fine.
He says, analysis of the session information from these 11 viewers indicates that the tasking for this project was probably not exact enough. And he admitted that right up front. But he said, this is a possible scenario based on the information provided. It doesn't indicate that this is the only possible scenario, nor does it prove that this scenario is more accurate than any other. So he ends up with an overview. A, this is what they decided. There was a large object low above the ground, which then went to the ground. The object was extremely large and was designed for transportation. It was of silvery gray or black color. So this is what they get. This is what they're saying they got from the remote viewers. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And B, there were people observing the vehicle who were interested, curious, and happy to see it. There was a coming at ya, and that's gonna hurt kind of attitude among those people, he said. He said there were one or more biologicals who were disabled or hurt, and someone was trying to help them, but could not do so because of an inability to understand. There were teams of people in helmets and protective clothing doing construction and deconstruction. And these teams appeared to work in shifts, waiting their turn. There was some kind of attempt at negotiation among the parties involved, but understanding was difficult. The negotiations may have ended in the unofficially observed execution of some of the participants. That was a tough one.
Janet, did Lynn go into detail about this execution of an ET? I mean, or maybe even more than one? I mean... What happened there? I mean, were we trying to put them out of their misery or something?
No, I'm looking through my other notes right now, and as I recall, see, I've got several sets of notes here. He said that apparently they could not. There was one woman, and when I read you last night, we talked about the woman who seemed to be kind of a policewoman, and that she was in charge of getting something done, and that somebody had actually fired into this room. And that apparently is what this was all about, that negotiations just fell apart and that the easiest solution for us was to execute this living being. And there were obviously several living beings.
Wow. Do you get the impression we killed all of the ETs?
You know, not really.
Okay.
I get the impression that there were several alive when this craft landed, from what he said and from what's in the report, and I get the impression that some of those beings that were still alive when the crash landed probably died, and that whatever kind of communication or negotiations or whatever was happening with this last living being, it ended in an execution. That's what I got from it.
Huh.
I don't know if that's exactly right, but that's...
Now, Janet, as part of the show... we're going to play an interview we did with Lynn, actually before the conference. And basically, this interview, the reason I'm playing it, it goes into detail about how I became a remote viewer and what the hazards are and what the advantages are and all of that. But before we get to that, you are convinced that Lynn Buchanan thinks Aztec, the 1948 UFO crash, happened, right?
Absolutely, yes. He said absolutely he believed that. He said the valuation, based on all the information that came in, was that there was a craft and that it did indeed crash. He said the valuation ended up saying that there were one or more EBEs who were hurt. And that at least one of them was executed.
And as far as you are concerned, it's still an open question. I mean, because we don't really know where they took the EBEs or the wreckage after the crash.
Well, like I said, he didn't. He had his own kind of ideas. He said that based on the information they got back from, he came up with a conclusion that it was some kind of university setting, or possibly, or that it was some kind of government setting, that it had kind of a campus that went with it. And that's where I came up with Los Alamos. I have a note here that says, looks like Los Alamos to me.
Uh-huh.
Because, and then I have a note underneath it that says, was Los Alamos like that in 1948? And I've been to Los Alamos a number of times and seen some old-timey pictures. And it seems to me that throughout World War II, the place grew, you just grew by leaps and bounds, and that it was pretty much a well-planned-out little town and very neat and clean and with, you know, with not only bunkhouses for the enlisted people, but very comfortable homes and buildings for teaching and stuff like that for everybody else. I remember seeing black and white pictures that, when I heard this, immediately came to mind.
Now, Janet, before we go to the interview that I recorded earlier with Lynn, you actually pinned him down on some news stuff. I thought something is pretty interesting, and we need to talk about that.
I asked him why, because he said they found Saddam Hussein. They found a whole lot. They're his crew. He said after 9/11, he knew immediately where he could find bin Laden. He offered to find bin Laden because I asked him, I said, if you can find Saddam Hussein, if you can find all these other people, why haven't we found bin Laden yet? And he said, the government doesn't want us to find bin Laden. He said, I could have done that within two or three days after 9/11, but they didn't want me to do that. And everybody said, why? And somebody said, exactly at the same time he said it, he said, because they didn't want him because there would be no more reason for a war. And that was when I pressed him, and I said, who is they? And he waved his hand, and he said, the government. And I said, what part of the government? And he said, I don't know from what part of the government. I said, well, was it our elected government? Was it the president? He said, I don't. And he just kind of passed off and would not answer that question.
Okay.
I don't know if he felt it was classified and he'd already told us too much or what. But he was very specific about the fact that not only did the group that he worked with know where Saddam Hussein was, they have always known. See, I've been kind of in my own personal feelings that bin Laden probably has been dead for the last several years from liver disease or whatever it is that makes him so sick. But he insists, he says he really believes bin Laden is still alive.
Huh.
So whatever that's worth.
Well, it might be worth quite a lot, Janet. We are, I don't want to give away the secrets here, but on our 9/11 series that comes up in August and September, we're debating about getting Lynn Buchanan and his company to remote view all of that, what happened at 9/11. I mean, I don't guess we'll present it as gospel, but it might be something for us to use as a baseline on our investigation. Anyway, thanks very much, Janet, for covering this for us. We appreciate you.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a bunch.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
And now let's go to the Lynn Buchanan interview we did earlier. I pick up the conversation with Lynn about the last time we talked.
I know. I think the last time I saw you was at a...
Lynn, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a while. I think the last time we were in Laughlin together, two or three years ago, at a UFO Congress.
It was. That's where it was, yeah.
Let's get right to the remote viewing of the Aztec 1948 crash scene. Now, they came to you, right? I mean, this was their idea.
Okay, we have been asked to have remote viewers take a look at the crash. You know, there's a lot of stuff out on the internet saying it's all a hoax and it's all fake and everything else, and then there are a bunch of eyewitnesses that say, well, if it was such a big fake, why did I see it?
You know? Yeah.
And so they wanted us to have remote viewers take a look and just find out what they get. And so we haven't told any of the remote viewers what the target is. We've just told them that they are remote viewing an event and to describe what they see.
Now, if I remember correctly from our last conversation, you were kind of like me. All these remote viewers are spread out all around the world.
They're all over the States, and in fact, there are several over in Europe and a couple over in other countries.
So how does this work? I mean, do they remote view all at the same time, or how? I mean, what explain
it. No, I just send out the tasking over email, and they do their sessions, and they send us the results. We compile the results and provide the answer in a report. We do that for companies, for corporations, for police departments, for archaeologists, and so forth.
You know, Lynn, I think our audience is always interested in the real story behind the guest, and yours is certainly an interesting story. You have a unique profession, for sure. Why don't you tell our audience, well, I guess, first of all, how you got started.
Well, I got started in the military. I was one of the military's controlled remote viewers, also the database manager, and wore several other hats in the military unit. Once I retired from the military, the controlled remote viewing unit and all that was still classified, and so I went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And then in late 1995, they effectively declassified the fact that the military had a remote viewing unit, what we did, and so forth. And so all of a sudden, they found out that I was the trainer. The public found out that I had been the trainer for the unit. And so I started getting in all of these requests for training. And I, at the time, was traveling 2.5 to 3 hours into D.C. every day, working a 12-hour day, and then traveling 2.5 to 3 hours going home. And it dawned on me that I could do this, you know, do the training, which I love to do, and not commute. And so
I guess you moved out to New Mexico, huh?
Yeah, well, I moved out to New Mexico a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
But and I still teach here. But, you know, I started teaching the public remote viewing, started teaching it to police, to businessmen, and so on. The controlled remote viewing is different from what people are calling remote viewing.
Well, tell me the difference.
Basically, the term remote viewing came about when they declassified. They declassified the unit and the fact that the government had been using remote viewing. They didn't tell anybody what it was. And so there were reporters in the D.C. area that were traveling around, you know, driving around the D.C. area looking for palm reader signs on front lawns and things like this, and going in and asking Madame Zoltar what remote viewing was. Well, it very quickly became what everybody did, you know. And once they found out that it was scientifically accepted, because it is a scientific process, then everybody started calling themselves remote viewers. And so these days, the term remote viewing is the new age term for psychic. And you can find palm remote viewers and crystal ball remote viewers and all that. controlled remote viewing is a science that was developed in the laboratories out at Stanford Research Institute to do espionage work for the government. And so, I mean, you can already see the difference here.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically, well, I think the best way to describe it, you know how a lie detector can tell whether you're lying or telling the truth. A good polygrapher can also tell if you're guessing. And a really good, highly trained polygrapher, believe it or not, can tell if you're guessing correctly or guessing incorrectly, even though you don't know the answer. The reason is that somewhere in your subconscious mind, I guess it's a connection with the collective unconscious or something, but the subconscious mind seems to know the answer. And through training, much like a martial art, you can get a person to be so sensitive to their own inner brainwave workings that they can make a guess and basically tell whether they're right or not. And, you know, within limits of human error.
Okay, Lynn, let's get a little more specific here. I was in the Army, too. It's a big organization. So how did you get into remote viewing in the first place? And was this a mixed unit or just the Army or what?
Oh, no, it was, by the time I got into it, it was Army.
Okay.
And the way I got into it, I know a lot of people don't believe in PK, you know, psychokinesis, but
mm-hmm.
I've had, well, I was one of those poltergeist kids growing up, and...
When you say poltergeist kid, you mean you saw ghosts?
Oh, no. Things fly off of shelves and things
okay,
like
I
that.
Okay, I got it. A mentalist, you could make things move. I just think about it and they jump off the table.
Yes, and, you know, poltergeist kids get a bad rap because most of the time the ones you hear about are the ones who are mentally unstable and all that. But the fact is that a lot of kids... have these poltergeist experiences, psychokinetic experiences. It scares them and they quit and all that. Well, when they started happening to me, I got fascinated by them and started studying them and started figuring out how to make it work. So anyway...
So you could really make objects move off the table and things, jump up and down,
I was getting to where I could do that, yeah.
Wow.
I was showing off for a cute little redheaded girl one day.
We have something in common. I have a weakness for redheads, too.
I tell you, Charlie Brown's life and my life coincide a lot. But I was showing off, and she was duly impressed and went home and told her father, the Pentecostal minister. And the next day, he and three of his deacons met me on the way home from school, and he, you know, just asked me a question, and by the time I finished my answer, he and his deacons had me down on the sidewalk with their hands pressing my face down into the ground, screaming for the devil to come out of me and all this other
stuff. Isn't that illegal? I mean, you were a minor, a child abuse there.
Well, I tell you, it scared the life out of me. And, I mean, this had always just been something neat that was happening.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it was my soul going to hell for doing any of
it. Lynn, where did you live when this happened? I'm just curious.
Oh, I was in Bell, California.
Okay.
Yeah, out in California.
Yeah, okay.
And so, anyway, I tried to suppress it and tried to suppress it. But one time in the military, I got just flaming angry, and computers just started going out. I've always had this problem of, you know, a lot of people have problems of... they get around computers and the computers start acting up and going crazy and all that. So it's not.
I didn't
uncommon.
Know that about people getting mad at computers and making the computers go crazy. That's interesting.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh. And
so you worked with computers when you were in the Army.
That's right.
Got to tell me more about this, Lynn. I mean, you got upset while on duty at the computers and screwed them up.
It just started frying computers. Well, at the time, there was an officer there who was looking for people who could do things like this because the military wanted to set up a unit that would be able to fry enemy computers. And so this guy witnessed that, and so he told the commanding general of the Intelligence and Security Command, and the next time the commanding general was out in Germany where I was stationed, he came by and he talked to me, and he just told me, you're going to be in a unit. Well, you know, you're going to help us form a unit to do this. Well, he got me back to D.C., and Congress would not fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a remote viewing unit there in Washington, D.C. area, and I was in D.C. He had nothing to do with me, and so he stuck me into the remote viewing unit. And
at that time, did the Army call it a remote viewing unit or what?
Well, they called it Operation Center Lane at the time.
Okay.
And that turned into Operation Stargate. They put me in this unit. And when they first read me on to what they do, you know, what they did, I thought I was on candid camera or something.
You thought they were putting you on, huh?
Oh, yeah. I thought, this is crazy. The Army doesn't do this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But sure enough, they did. And
hold on, Lynn. We got to take a break. This is interesting stuff. Lynn Buchanan's our guest. We're talking about remote viewing. I'm Jerry Pippin. Now, before we get back to the interview of Lynn Buchanan, I would like to take an opportunity here to talk to you just briefly about the Aztec Library and their organization, the Friends of the Aztec Library. Now, they have been doing wonderful, wonderful work. If you ever get a chance to Aztec and you take a look at that library, you'll know what I mean. And a lot of the funds to build that library came from the Aztec Symposiums. 13 years now they've had it, and I'm sure they're looking forward to a good one next year, year 14. Now, if you can't get to Aztec, and we have listeners all around the world, so a lot of people are far, far from the Four Corners area of New Mexico, but you can help the Friends of the Library very simply by sending them a tax-free donation. They would appreciate it, whether it's $10, $25, $100, $1,000, whatever, it'll go to good use. You can see the address to the Aztec Library here on our website, or if you want to use PayPal, click on their link to their website, and you'll see the information on how you can donate. I urge you to do it. Be a friend of the Aztec Library, won't you? Welcome back. This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Lynn Buchanan, and we're talking about remote viewing. And at the break, Lynn was explaining what happened in the Army when they sent him to the unit that did remote viewing. You thought they were putting you on completely, I take it. I mean, you thought you were on candid camera.
So
you really thought they were just putting you on.
Yeah, this is crazy. The Army doesn't do this kind of stuff. But sure enough, they did. And I tell you, I took to it like a duck to water, and it just became so natural.
Can you tell me your first controlled remote viewing experiment with the Army? Or is that classified?
It wasn't Terry Waite. It was one of the Iranian hostages.
Remember the year? What year that was?
I think it was around 79. No, it was around 84, I think.
Oh, okay.
84.
Okay.
But this was a political hostage over in the Middle East. And we were keeping track of him every day. And, of course, during this time, I was being trained myself in how to do this technology.
Okay, now, during this time in the Army, who was training you?
Ingo Swan.
I know him.
Researcher with SRI had developed this technique. He had taught the members of the unit. I was supposed to train with him, and yet the Congress cut the contract the week before I got there. And so I was training from the other members of the unit who had trained with Ingo.
Mm-hmm.
I have since become friends with Ingo, and just a totally fascinating, talented person. But I was trained by the members of the unit. And like I say, it just came so natural to me, and I love it.
And I still don't understand it exactly. When you remote view something, control remote viewing, is it like watching a movie, or do you feel things, or is it a dream, or what?
It starts out kind of like a dream state.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it wide awake. There's no trance. There's no altered state or anything else.
So and maybe daydream would be better than dream. But I mean, it's almost like you're there.
They monitor it there and ask you a question about what's around you. And you can look over, or you can listen, or you can smell, or, you know, sniff the air.
Well, as I said, it's almost like you're there.
It is almost like you're there, yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, the other thing, are you saying time does not exist? You can go back, like to 1948, to the Aztec crash, or forward, or whatever?
In controlled remote viewing, there is no difference structurally between saying move forward 5 feet, or move forward 5 years, or move back, you know, move back 1 mile, you can say move back 10 years. And structurally, there's no difference. The remote viewer just does it. And starts.
How is this possible? I mean, is there an explanation scientifically?
There are probably as many theories about it as there are people.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are as many theories as there are experts. And none of them agree.
Yeah.
And the fact is that nobody knows. However, we know that it works. We know how to work it. And as a result, we worked it, you know, through basically three wars, and saved a lot of lives, saved the government a lot of money.
When you say saved a lot of money, saved a lot of lives, are we talking about going behind enemy lines with these remote viewers, just thinking about things and figuring it out?
Or we'll do tomorrow. The Gulf War, we knew ahead of time what Saddam Hussein was going to do the following day of battle, and we passed that information up through the Department of Defense. The guy didn't stand a chance. When the helicopter that was going to rescue the Iranian hostages,
mm-hmm.
when that thing crashed, the remote viewers knew it and sent the information up through the chain of command, and the president got our report of the crashed helicopter actually 10 minutes before the electronic confirmation came through from Iran.
On that Iranian hostage thing with the aborted rescue attempt with the sandstorm, what really happened?
They just hadn't planned for a sandstorm. Sand got into the motor and into the rotor
uh-huh.
and everything else, and it just took the helicopters out.
I mean, you guys didn't tell them it was going to be a sandstorm?
Nobody asked us. We were limited. See, back in the 60s, the government got caught doing mind control
mm-hmm.
experiments.
Yeah, I remember.
And so they were very, very careful about letting us do anything without specific tasking from a customer. And in fact, we weren't allowed to do that. And so if no one tasked us, we didn't do the work.
Lynn, do you think we're still doing, I mean, the military, are they still doing remote viewing?
Well, I don't know. When you retire, they quit telling you. See, I hope that they have the military unit now, I think they would be crazy not to. You know, it'd be stupid for them not to have it, but then that changes the question to, does our government ever do anything stupid or not?
And you're doing controlled remote viewing in private enterprise now. I mean, you have your own company, and corporations are your clients mostly. Can you tell us exactly what you're doing now with this?
Okay. I'm, of course, teaching. We teach.
When you say teaching, what do you mean?
We, after 6 years of training, we allowed one other teacher to start working with us. And she lives in Amarillo, Texas, and does a fantastic job. I mean, she is extremely well-trained. She's a top-point remote viewer, and she's a good teacher. The higher-level classes I teach, either here in my home or else generally in another country, I will go, you know, I'm going over to Ireland and England this year and maybe Canada. I've been to Australia and other countries, Japan and all that. But, you know, I do the teaching for the upper-level courses, and a woman named Lori Williams does a basic course in Amarillo, Texas.
So she's in your company?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And what is the name of the company?
Problems Solutions Innovations, PSI.
And you have a website, of course, and we have a link to it.
We certainly do. It's called CRVIEWER.com.
For potential clients, may I ask, are you expensive?
Fairly. and we make absolutely certain that it's worth it. When we train, it's $1,000 a course, but we stay with you after the course is over. We continue the education. We database all of your work from then on. Also, you can come back to the course as many times as you want to for the rest of your life at no charge, you know, for review, for auditing, and renewal, and so on. Like I say, we database your work. Since we keep a database on your work, we know your strengths and weaknesses, and so we vouch for you for any customers that you might want to have. You know, if somebody comes, the police, let's say, come and say they want you to look into a case, but they want proof that you can do the work, we have the database, we have, I mean, firm, hard proof that you can do the work.
Now, what is the difference between what you do for the police department and, say, a psychic?
We provide details. CRV, controlled remote viewing, is all about details. A regular psychic, and by the way, there are some really, really good psychics out there. I'm not putting them down at all. There are a lot of them that I see their work and I think, boy, I wish I could do that, you know. They will tend to give generalities, and one of the downfallings of psychics is that they jump to conclusions. In CRV, we're taught never to do that.
Well, you don't jump to conclusions or draw a conclusion. I guess we call you emotionally neutral. What percentage, Lynn, do you have as commercial clients to, say, police departments?
We do a lot for police departments simply because we never charge them. When people come, they have missing children or something like that. We always work through the police department. We never work for families because when you do, that just puts them on an emotional roller coaster. It tears the family up more than anything else to work with a psychic. It always does. Also, you have families get something from the psychic or from the remote viewer, and they go out and trample crime scenes and, you know, and it's just never good. So,
as far as crime scenes, you don't have to be there. You can be halfway around the world, a little different than many psychics. Now, how about your corporate customers? What do you do for them?
The corporate clients want, you know, future projections. They'll have enough money for maybe one or two projects that they have, and yet they'll have five or six projects on the table. Well, they want to know which ones are going to make money and which ones are going to fail. And what we do is we will take each project and actually work it out as to the results of that
then
project.
By work it out, you mean you actually go forward in the future and tell them what will happen?
That's right, yeah.
And there's no limit on how far forward you can go?
No. Then we, you know, find out what unforeseen influences are going to affect those projects and so forth. And we present that information to the company, and as a result, then they have a better decision-making process. We don't make the decision for them. We just tell them what's going to happen with each project if they follow.
I'm curious. How far back have you gone in the past? I mean the furthest. Yourself, personally.
We have gone back through prehistoric times.
Really?
Yeah, and of course what we're looking for is things that are physically provable. And as we do our training, we never do things like Melchizedek of the planet Scooby-Doo or whatever, you know, the galactic.
So you don't do things like go up to Mars and look around and validate things?
We do things that are physically feedbackable, physically provable.
Okay.
And that way we can keep a track record of the strengths and weaknesses of all the viewers. And when we actually go into work for companies and all, like if we go to work for an archaeologist and we say dig here, we want to find out what's in the hole just as well as they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if we don't find out, then we have no feedback for our viewers and we have no way to track their strengths and weaknesses.
So you've actually been doing remote viewing for at least three decades, Lynn.
Yeah. Man, that makes me feel old.
Well, I mean, you know, this seems like this could be something that would be emotionally draining, but you seem to be holding up pretty well.
I would like to give another website here.
Sure, go ahead and plug it.
www.8martinis.com.
That's an interesting name, an interesting URL. 8martinis.com.
Well, when people in the government found out what we were doing and that they were, you know, using our intelligence, and that we had actually a higher accuracy than any other intelligence organization, even Spy in the Sky satellites. And when they found out about us, the joke was that they would be so shocked that they would go out and have an 8-martini lunch. And so this is a publication that's free for downloading. 8 Martinis, it's a comes out once every 4 to 6 months. And it has a lot of information about the remote viewing and about what is done and so forth by a lot of the different people who are in the unit.
Well, Lynn, it's been very interesting finding out about remote viewing and you as a person. It's been nice talking to you. Hope we can visit again soon.
Well, good.
Thanks
talking
for coming
to you.
On.
Hope I get to see you again.
Okay, me too.
All right.
That was our recording we made with Lynn Buchanan about remote viewing. And in summary, we need to go over exactly what's happened here. It's still a work in progress, and we expect to get a further report from Lynn later on. He had 11 remote viewers. They were tasked with the idea of just enough information that they could zero in on whether or not there was a crash at Aztec in 1948 with a UFO. And the information came back, by and large, from all 11, saying that there indeed was a crash. And some startling news also came about. More than one remote viewer seemed to be picking up a signal, if that's the term, that, in fact, the United States government, somebody, a police officer, an MP, a military officer, an enlisted man, somebody shot an ET and killed him because the ET was not going along with the program. Whatever that program was, we assume we were trying to rescue them. At least that's what we hope was happening. We also got some mixed signals about where they took the debris and the survivors, and if indeed there were survivors, and it appears there were. And we are going to follow up on that, I'm sure. This was a great idea by Katie McClure, who works with the Friends of the Library Association out there in Aztec. And as you know, the symposium, the money goes toward the library. And they have a state-of-the-art library out there in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico. And I mean that affectionately because New Mexico is one of my favorite states. And there's some pretty nice areas there, unique and scenic and hard to get to. But if you get a chance, I would urge you to consider Aztec as part of your vacation plans. And if you go to Aztec, by all means, go by the library. It appears that they're going to continue to follow this up. I do know that this initial report, the one we talked about earlier in the program of Janet Saylor, is available now at the Aztec Library. So if you're in the area, you can actually go by there and read the report for yourself. I don't think they'll let you check it out, but I guess you can sit there and make copies of it or whatever. And as I say, we'll be following this up with Lynn Buchanan later. One other thing about the Aztec Library and the Friends of the Aztec Library, on their website, and we have a link to it on our website, where this program is, as a matter of fact, you can go over there to their website, and we have a link, as I say, and make a donation to the library. If you could not make the symposium, I would really ask you to make a donation to the Aztec Public Library. It's a good cause. It's tax deductible. They have a PayPal thing there. They also have, and we do too, their mailing address if you want to send a check. And they would appreciate it. And we will continue to follow the Aztec crash of 1948. As we said in the opening of the show, at least four UFO crashes occurred in New Mexico from July 1947 right on up through March of 1948 and maybe beyond. There is some evidence, scant as it may be, that there might have even been an ET UFO landing at Los Alamos. We're trying to follow all of that up. And we do urge you to follow our new Internet TV series, Roswell Revelations and Beyond, which comes out with a segment about once a month, as we will continue to cover the Aztec crash and the other crashes in New Mexico. And, of course, be sure and join us in Roswell, New Mexico, over the 4th of July. Jane Swartley has been our web producer. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin, and we thank Janet Saylor and aspiefiles.org and her great little symposium that comes about in September. We'll be up there, too, at Angel Fire. New Mexico is our second home, it appears. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers.